This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Welcome to the Lensing, Santa Fe's Performing Arts Center. On behalf of the theater and the person seated next to you, we ask that you take a moment to please silence your cell phones and pagers. There is also no recording or photography permitted during this evening's performance. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Wow, these lights are so bright I can't see anyone. Okay, I know you're here. I hear you and I feel you. Thank you so much for welcoming us here to Santa Fe and to the Lannan Foundation's ongoing, amazing series of presenting artists to you all. We're so honored and pleased to be here. I'm not the best extemporaneous speaker, but I will try my best to say all the things that should be said, and I ask forgiveness for anything I might leave out, and know that it was not intentional. The Dark Room Collective, as you know, was established 25 years ago, and so this is the final, we think, reading of our 25th reunion tour. And you have probably read some things and heard some things about the collective, so I won't go on and on too much about our history, but I did want to make a couple of comments regarding certain aspects of the collective's history and ethos, and I also want to give thanks. In African cosmogony, ancestors are our family, both personal and collective, who have passed into the realm of spirit, but who remain connected to us through the sustaining memories that we hold of them, the guidance we seek from them, and the honor we give them for the sacrifice, their work, and their love. So it seemed fitting to the Darkroom Collective in establishing its reading series 25 years ago, sparked as that event was by the passing of our great griot, James Baldwin, that we honor always our ancestors, and that we began a tradition of honoring what we call our living literary ancestors, as well as those who have passed on. So thus was the beginning of a reading series meant to honor the writers who were so influential and important in shaping our wishes and our hopes and our work as aspiring and emerging writers. And that was the beginning of this amazing 25-year journey that brings us here to Santa Fe. Along the way, we have lost many, many of those ancestors, living ancestors, to the true realm of the ancestors, the spirit realm. I just wanted to mention in tribute a few of those. There are many, as I said, but a few of those who recently passed away to give honor to them as a way to open our reading tonight. So I want to just call out some of the names. You may also have names that you want to call out. I'm particularly calling out those writers of color because the Darkroom Reading Series was a series that was meant to especially make room for the voices of writers of color. So I call out the names of Wanda Coleman, Jane Cortez, Jose Esteban Munoz, Seamus Heaney, William Demby, Lucille Clifton, Chenua Achebe, James Emanuel, Luis Reyes Rivera, and Kofi Awunor. Ashe. Before we begin, of course, I'd like to give thanks to the Lannan Foundation and the staff there who have made this possible. Thank you, of course, to Patrick Lannan and to Camille Lannan. The Lannan Foundation actually played a role in the early darkroom history with a generous grant from the foundation, which was administered by our fiscal sponsor, Plowshares Literary Journal. The Darkroom Collective was able to move our reading series from our house, from our living room, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to such institutions as the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston and later the Boston Playwrights Theater under the auspices of Derek Walcott. So who knew? It was both fortuitous but also prophetic that we had that early relationship with the Lannan Foundation. So I want to thank again Patrick and Camille Lannan, and also thanks to Joe Chapman, to Christy Mazuera Davis, and thanks to Martha Jessup, who actually, because she saw the Darkroom Collective read at the AWP conference in Boston, suggested that we be brought here. So thank you to those Lannan folks and all of the other staff that make this work possible. And I also want to give a thanks to Amy Schroth and her students at the Monte del Sol Charter School. I know you all are out there in the audience. And I believe there was another school. Did you want to mention your?
Performing Arts School today.
The Performing Arts School that
I can't remember the
where exam. Thomas and James spoke with their students. We want to thank you all for welcoming us into your classrooms and you know, for your generous time and appreciation of our work. Okay, so before I talk all my time away, I'm going to read, and thanks, of course, to you all for being here. I never quite know what to read, so I'm going to bite off of Thylias Moss and ask, first of all, any requests? I love it that she did that at a reading once, that she had that confidence, but that also she charged the audience to be aware of your poets and to, you know, to know their work in the way that you know your musicians and call out requests for songs at concerts. You can call out requests for poems at readings. So any case, I'll read a couple of poems, maybe one from this collection of childhood poems. I felt that there was a theme emerging in some of the poems I decided to read, and it seems to have a kind of memorial theme. And so maybe that's because this is the wind-up of our tour. So in any case, and there's also another theme, conjuration. I'll take Tisa's word. Tisa has a course called Conjuration. Wouldn't you want to take a course called Conjuration? So that word kind of crops up. So I guess I'll start with this poem. And it also has to do with the past and has to do with memory, and it's called Night Work. In the changeling air before morning, they are silhouettes, dark ones with the duskiness of pre-dawn on them and the shading of dust and sweat. Busying themselves in buildings, on scaffolds, and on the black-washed pavements, they are phantoms of the city, guardians of parking lots and lobby desks, toll booths, meters, the all-nights, and delivery trucks. At bus stops, they are sentinels and the drivers, launderers and cleaners, readying the offices and the untidy houses of privilege, cooks heaping up meals for the well-fed, the disabled, or the indifferent, trash takers making room for more, nurses eternally watching. When my mother, starting the stove at 5 a.m., looked out the window, she saw her father days after his funeral. Had he come back to the field and the plowing left undone when the chain snapped and struck him, knotting his throat into pain and its aftershock of silence? Did he return to reclaim the work like a part of himself unfulfilled and his story untold? He is with us still, she said, to the inchoate brightness. He is there even now. Spirits are much the same in those uncensored hours, flitting dim figures, half-remembered apparitions whose industry renews and undergirds our own. They are our counterparts, the whispering echo of that other, turning as we turn in bed, the sigh that heaves in the wake of some unseen act. In the darkness, where a cycle of making and unmaking unfolds. If anything could help us believe in their benign presence, it is the workers, perpetual as stars, a collective of eyes and hands conjuring. Thanks very much. I'm just doing this randomly. So I'll read this poem because it conjures up a moment with the collective when one of our guests of our reading series, Toy Derricotte, the founder of the Foundation for Black Poetry known as Caveh Kanem, Toy Derricotte, and this was before all of that happened, but she came to the dark room and we took her out for ice cream and we sat around and had an impromptu writing workshop where she challenged each of us to write a poem based on a word that she gave us. And the word she gave me was snow. And I grew up in Orangeburg, South Carolina, where it doesn't snow. But then I remembered something about that. It did snow once in my childhood. So that's what this poem is based on, Snow for Toy Derricotte. It came once, the year I turned 10. That year, they told us how we would become women, and I began my monthly vigil. But this was the miracle, singular, unexpected. The whites had finally stopped resisting. Unwanted at their school, we went anyway. Historic, our parents intoned, eyes splashing caution to our measured breaths. That first martial autumn mellowed into a winter of grudging acceptance and private discontent, a season of hope shaped by fists and threats. Then angels molted, pelting all of creation with their cast-off garb. We went home early, drifting through a landscape of sudden ghosts, the yard churning in frothy waves as if by an invisible tide of protesters. What I remember most is its rude coldness, stinging and wet, how we mixed it with milk, sugar, vanilla, into a poor child's ice cream that melted before we could savor it. Thank you. I'm going to read another sort of winter-related poem. And also, nature is one of those obsessions for me, one of the themes that crops up in my poetry. Having grown up in a rural southern landscape, nature and animals and such things are very present for me. So I'm very mindful of nature. I pay attention and I'm affected by the changing seasons and the light. So in coming here and again and seeing this beautiful landscape, this vast open landscape, I decided to read this poem. I live in Atlanta, which is a southern urban place, and it's very different from the landscape of my childhood. But I just wanted to read this poem. And I'm not a big fan of Atlanta traffic. I don't drive, but just the traffic is there. And so anyway, that's what sparked this poem. It's called Atlanta Winter. I want to say these bare trees make a composed view or frame or sculpture by their posture, leaning, reaching out and into stark, livid space. That what goes on beyond there once was and once more canopy, if spring equals mercy, strives, as they do, for memorial. But they seem indifferent to craft. Late afternoon's light prismed through icy air, saffron brushstrokes shaping lakes in a litmus paper sky. A soundtrack rising from their own stripped branches, birds chittering in a melisma of farewell. Winter's inviolable. unmindful of the lush work of more vainer, of vainer seasons, it revises the landscape's aboriginal charm, flowers and grasses in elegant, somber surrender, houses in genuflection on their loamy plots, trees echoing all over their stoic repose. Yet winter can't dissemble these overrun streets I dart through as buses and cars honk coda to traffic lights, Morse blinking red, green. Its own artistry is marred by these discordant notes, though I want to call them song. Thank you. I'll just read a couple more. I guess I'm just going to continue with this theme. this next poem takes its opening lines. It's a slight revision on an opening line of a Mary Oliver poem. And this is simply called Poem. When I have to die, I want to die on a day that is full of sun. The sky, fierce, oniric blue. The earth, its brazen accomplice, brimming gold. From dawn's slow blast to the blare of late afternoon, let there be an effusion of radiance everywhere. In that wide brightness, I would feel my heart struggle against its tether one last time before I'm aloft in warmth, a dervish pulsing to sparkle and buoyant glow. Then I would be glad for the friends who would come from far places in planes sailing through the quicksilver air with cities and nature spread below, who would look out on those glittering surfaces and know all that is left to love. On such a day, the world would go on with its giddy traffic and quiet bloom, and the light filling it would remind you of those parties that last well into the night, and whose countless guests spill through rooms ablaze with music or drift off to corners to share their life stories. Okay. I'm going to read. I had promised the class, Amy's class, that I would read a poem called Auntie Hoodoo Speaks. And they were going to be the first ones to hear it. But because I couldn't get my computer to work, now you're all going to hear it. So, but this is for the Monte del Sol students. And this poem is, we were talking about ekphrastic poetry in her class, and I was saying, and Tisa read this wonderful ekphrastic piece from her book, and but I was saying that what I do with art oftentimes is not so much describe the piece so that you can visualize it in your mind, but I take that piece as the jumping-off point. And in this case, you won't get a full description of the Conjure Woman, which is the collage by Romare Bearden that evoked the poem. But what you will get is the persona of the Conjure Woman, whom I've named Auntie Hoodoo in the Southern tradition. You will get to hear her speak in the poem. So Auntie Hoodoo speaks. Every family's got at least one conjurer. It's true. I'm a scapegoat when they're angry. But when they're hurting, here they come, beating down my door. Many a pious Bible thumper's got a little sack with asafoetida and a wishbone tied with thread tucked in her bosom. She's got a bowl of water under the bed. I'm the subject of scuttlebutt, but when certain of the Lord's mysteries need penetrating, when he moves too slow, they seek me out. You've got to know how to draw out what's hidden in things. I ain't working with nothing ain't already there. You can't be afraid to claim a healer's right, to handle the subtle energies, harness the forces of life to your will. The snake knows gravity, the physics of flight, as much as the bird. And it knows paralysis, too, the efficacy of venom. I don't mind being fearsome. What I do, they scorn me for, but only if it fails. If they insist on probing the charred bundle before burying it, if they can't stand the bitter rootstock, if they ignore my readings of the signs, have I increased their trouble? Or did they, with their own fears, block the path I've tried to clear? This work is fraught with risk. What I do ain't no trifle. I know the secrets, the sins. After the midwife and the preacher, there's me. The difference is I'm the one they can lie about, the one they visit only by the back door. Yet I'm in between, really, a balancer, hand to God, hand to Mama. I'm drawing on the sun and moon, these fields, all these crawling and flying things, trees and water, everything speaking through me. Something else I figured, testing this juju. I'm outside of time just as much as I'm in this time right now. What I mean is connected to all the past and responsible to the generations coming behind us. Don't take this for ego, but I feel ideal injustice, like those ancestors who fought so we would know truth. Not that I'm a Harriet Tubman, no, not such a mountain. Some say she carried a gun, but think about it. Miss Harriet had to have moved with intimate understanding of the sublime workings of this world, and others too, I believe. I'm talking about sacrifice, summoning and giving shape to a knowing that's not easy to fathom or control. But I got sense enough to know it ain't for me alone. I'm simply bound to make it manifest to whatever end spirit intends. Not that anyone's going to sing me into history. You could say, though, I can make a way. My place is on the outside and in the center. I'm conducting in all directions at once. My faith can't be puny, not with this power. Thank you. And I want to end with this little poem, and it's probably still a work in progress because I wrote it very quickly, but this little poem, Savannah in the Sky, for Madiba, Nelson Mandela. If heaven is your own, it is the landscape of your dreams. Here, an ocean of earth reflects the fields of gray waves, perhaps the view that only you can see. Wildfires plague the distance like flashes of lightning, another's landscape, a mythic hell that counterbalances all heavens. But here, in your dreams, children play in fields, in grassy plains that stretch behind you, and a wind grooms the weeds that meet you at the horizon and go on and on and on where there should be clouds. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Hi, everybody. Good evening. I'm Tisa Bryant. Hello. I'm really happy to be here. And thanks to the Lannan for having us. I'm going to read. I keep changing my mind. I'm going to read from Unexplained Presence, which is a book of hybrid essays about Black presences in film, literature, and visual art. And each piece is, the book is divided with ekphrastic pieces that comment on the essay that ended and set up the one that begins. And I think I'm going to stick to my original idea and read this one. And I want to dedicate it to Wanda Coleman, who is always presumed to be a shark, and she was the kindest woman and an amazing poet and unapologetically Black and female. So this is the setup piece. It is as if the nurse were quite out of control. The other side of nursing, the opposite of helping, of the helping, healing hand is the figure of destruction, the devouring predator whose inhuman and indifferent impulses pose immediate danger. Never still, always hungry, these figures are nevertheless seductive, elusive, and theatrical in their combination of power and deceit, love and death. Toni Morrison, Disturbing Nurses and the Kindness of Sharks. In Melville's Jungle. There's no greater solitude than that of the samurai, unless it is that of the tiger in the jungle, the Bushido, Book of the Samurai. The gait of the predator, measured in matte fashion, precise gray two-piece suit, brief gloss on black leather lace-up shoes, his hand reaching up in signature style to hone the edge of his brim. He's sharp, this samurai, a tiger in his solitude, camouflaged by surfaces, masked by color palette. He lies on the bed, in his shirt sleeves, ankles crossed, cupping a hot galois. The walls, sheets, floor, the cage bird singing contentedly, all complement the cool earth tones before the indirect glare of white light obscuring the outer landscape, filling the window frame like a blank movie screen. The only motion we see is a snaky cloud of smoke rising from the white shirt sleeves into white light toward the black shadowed ceiling. Young Jean-Pierre Grumbach watched White Shadows in the South Seas, listened to the first words ever heard in film, civilization, civilization, and decided that he too would adventure into the human landscape and create worlds. He also loved Herman Melville and so changed his name to Jean-Pierre Melville. With his camera, he went on the hunt for bright beasts and shadowy creatures, and where he didn't find them, he made them up, like the quote from the Bushido that begins his film, Le Samurai, Tripmaster Melville, his fake book. Animal logic and suppressed narratives of adventurous desire, it all blends in Melville's jungle. The bird tweets periodically. Le Samurai rises suddenly, gracefully. In two steps, he's across the room, hiding a mutilated wad of cash. He dons his Burberry, shakes out shoulders and sleeves, sharpens his brim at the mirror, and he's out. The bird says goodbye. He stalks down the boulevard, selects an unlocked Peugeot. Sitting stock still, he methodically tries one forged master key after another in the ignition until he's off. The samurai is neither smug nor self-satisfied. Prowess is its own expression. He remains poker-faced, in control. At a stoplight, a creamy-skinned brunette in a similar voiture cruises up. She stares at him openly, all liner and lashes. Am I your animal? He looks her over, unfazed. She puffs out her lips. The traffic light signal turns. He steps on the gas, hightails it through the rainy streets to his garage man, who silently swaps out the plates on the stolen Peugeot and sells Le Samurai a revolver. He drives away to a posh apartment complex, goes in and stands at the door, rings the bell. A honey blonde, Jane LaGrange, stands in silk wrapper. He enters. She welcomes him into her arms. Jane LaGrange is played by Nathalie Delon, Alain Delon's then real-time wife. They do not kiss. She is solicitous. He sits on the bed, checks his watch. I was here from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m., he says. No way, she says. Wiener will be here at 2. Wiener, the sugar daddy, the mark. So I was here from 7 to 1:45. She looks pleased with that. I like it when you come to my house, Jeff, because you need me. She gazes at him with a soft smile. He looks away. Gray hat on, trench coat collar up, profile impeccable. She stares at him. He rises and leaves. He enters a nightclub. The place is jumping. A beautiful young woman plays piano, jiving and smiling. Le jazz hot. Le samurai heads straight for the men's room, puts on white latex gloves. He strides behind the mirrored wall of the nightclub scene, down a long hallway of closed doors, opens one, and fatally shoots the man behind the desk before the man has a chance to shoot back. He turns, leaving, and walks smack into the path of Le Pianiste, standing elegantly in a long gown, sparkling in the dark hall. Their eyes lock. Close up. Are you domesticated or wild? She stares at him, commanding the stage of the hallway, snug, sequined, stunning. The samurai stares back. His mouth barely twitches, but he's been spotted. He disappears down the hallway, out of the club, and into the night. Love has two faces, each with an alibi. He was here with me, says Jane LaGrange to the cops. She loves Jeff, but sugar daddy Wiener pays the bills. The inspector calls Jane a prostitute. The cops return later, toss around her lingerie. The inspector tries to cut her a deal, tries to get her to turn on Le Samurai. She won't budge. I've never seen that man before, says Kati, Le Pianiste, at the police lineup. Her voice comes in after she tinkled piano keys with long African fingers, her lovely Martinican face jiving, shoulders swinging, lips pursed full, now glorious teeth, flash of black-lined eyes. Princess Tam Tam goes mad. Again. Well, you needn't. Her boss was shot by Le Samurai. He shot from the hip, quickly and cleanly. Kati watched, aghast, as he stepped backwards from the scene of the crime. We don't see her watch. Her music covers for him. It began when their eyes locked in silence, her voice. That is definitely not him, she says, eyes in close-up on Le Samurai. Alain Delon stares quietly, penetratingly, questioningly back. Kati's eyes are glossy onyx, her hair sparkles, her limbs model thin beneath plunge-cut sheaths. She cuts him slack to the police, says she's never seen him, when in the hallway they stared at each other, tiger and sleek house cat. Kati becomes the black question mark snaking through his mind. Everyone else is interrogated. He was here with me, Jane repeats. The blonde love, the devoted love. She, too, lies. But who really saves you, Jeff? She cries. But whose eyes do you recall? When he returns home, Le Samurai's bird tweets in warning. Kati, the jazz hot, is very cool. The star witness who also lies for Jeff. Out of love? There is amour in Samurai. For her? Why would she lie for this stranger? Years later, she too is interrogated by an off-screen female voice for Paris TV. Why acting? You can't be a model forever, she says. I'm 24. I have a child of my own to support. Kati strikes a number of poses, ingenue, gamine, la présence africaine. In mud cloth cloak. She's a good model. Dandridge, Carol, Barry. Look to the mark. See to her. You're very beautiful, Kati recounts the magazine editor's pronouncement as she flipped through Kati's books of headshots. But you're absolutely not our type. No one in France can identify with you. It's 1970. But I am dark and comely. Oh, Kati, do you think that? Show me to the children of Césaire, the sisters of Fanon. Do they not live here? Can they not see? The unseen female inquisitor's voice insinuates, with a partner as Alain Delon, surely. Surely what? A partner, says the inquisitor, not actor, not lead. Not co-star. Instead, Melville's barely submerged narrative of interracial desire is projected onto Kati. It's her reality, her responsibility. So she expresses her gratefulness at being Melville's chosen. No one questions the reason. It goes without saying. Critic Jonathan Rosenbaum calls Kati Le Pianiste a black angel of death derived from Cocteau's Orphée. I suppose you have an easier time with men than women, the inquisitor persists. Much easier, Kati replies plainly. I'm not surprised. Sisters of Fanon, where are you, cries Kati. Do you not recognize this voice of mistress, the wife of Plantation Picoul's master? Can you not see my face? My smile does not kill. The phone rings. She ignores it. It's not her future calling. Kati glides across the nightclub stage to her piano. She wraps her tiger print fur around her shoulders. The female inquisitor continues, so you're an actress by instinct? The eye of the camera closes in on Kati until she is only eyes, nose, and magnificent white teeth. Peut-être, she smiles. Through the streets and stolen cars, the surveillance bugs in the curtains and the dragnet encircling him, Kati's brown face returns to Le Samurai, returns him to the nightclub. We have to accept her mythically and abstractly, says Rosenbaum, not as any kind of psychological or spiritual entity. Yet she is supported by the poetry of fairy tale. Black angels of death need no motivation. They spring fantastically out of our foreheads and simply act on instinct. Whose animal is she? After Kati's set, she and Le Samurai get in her black Mustang. We see a Caribbean woman in a leopard fur coat driving an American muscle car named for a wild horse that's notoriously, mythically hard to break. What poem, what fairy tale is this? The seats, the steering wheel are blood red. Kati drives like she plays piano. She's not good at faking it. She takes Le Samurai to where she's kept, in a mob nest, and she's evasive, enigmatic. Their feet sink into carpet as they dance around each other without making a sound. She wears a black kimono, swirls in a white fur swivel chair on the upper level of a white wall duplex covered in modern art. Piano music plays from nowhere. She stretches out barefoot on a platform bed covered in a black zebra print sheet. The boudoir becomes dark with hairy rugs and heavy wood. Melville watches, perched as if from an unseen balcony, as if high in a tree. His jungle scene is reaching its zenith. Now the shadow people who ordered the nightclub hit are out to eliminate Le Samurai. She doesn't say she likes it when he comes to her house because he needs her. She says, call me at 2 a.m. Why did you say you didn't recognize me at the police station? He asked Kati. Why did you kill Marty? They paid me to. I have to know who hated Marty enough to have him killed, he says. Why should you care? She replies. Someone is trying to kill him now. He sits spread-eagled on a backwards Eames chair, chin resting on folded hands, gazing at her. The camera holds him, his blue eyes, liquid, repentant, suicidal. Kati, what do you behold in this man, come to put his life in your hands, and do you want the responsibility for it? The little bird tweets. In his interrogations by the press, Melville says, filming is a tiresome formality. I prefer writing and editing, the inspiration and the finishing touches. What is Kati's touch, and what does it finish? Civilization, civilization. Kati, lithe and lovely, steps down the stairs out of Jeff's reach. She sits at her piano and plays. She is not to be attained. He thinks otherwise. His credo follows the cunning of the tiger. He runs his hands through her hair, lets it trail down her nape. The touch of the lover, the killer, savior, and sinner, it's all on the same line. He stands behind her, touches her. Her move away from his trigger finger is telltale, marked by desire. She moves into his touch before veering off again with the tinkling of the keys. Cut quick to Jane's. She answers the door before he's knocked. Jeff, she senses his presence somehow, by ear or smell. It's unclear which. She's had trouble with the police, yes, but not because of him. Never because of him. She offers herself as the animal for him, no matter what. Her bed is covered in white fur. They stand in profile. He holds her by the shoulders, squeezes, gives her a peck on the ear, through her hair, turns to go. She stares after him. He doesn't look back. The door clicks shut. The samurai breaks into the mob nest. Kati is not there. She too, like Jane the fawn, is a kept woman. She is kept by the mob boss who orders hits. She doesn't act like it. The samurai kicks in the door, snatches the boss by the lapels. You got the $4 million? The boss inquires coolly. Oui. Then you accept the contract? Oui. Blam! The samurai is faster. The mob boss falls, one bloody bullet in him. He returns again to the scene of the crime, the nightclub. We see the gun chamber in his hand, 6 bullets, cut. He enters the joint resounding with jazz, a black jazz combo, and dons white gloves in full view. The bartender, who colluded on the original hit, backs away. Kati comes on stage in a white off-shoulder gown trimmed with gold. She sits at a small organ and plays something deep and tremulous. Jeff walks deliberately to Kati at the keys. "Don't stay here," she warns him, shaking her head to her own slow, dolorous organ echoing soul. He pulls the revolver from his trench and points it at her. Melville the hunter darts his camera between their staring eyes, their faces filling the screen. "Pourquoi, Jeff?" Kati asks. "I was paid to." Her eyes widen. He makes to shoot. She flinches in fear. The samurai is shot by two cops in hiding. "You had a close call," says one cop. "Non," says the grim inspector, flipping open Jeff's revolver. The chambers are empty. Kati's eyes shut in grief, or it's double ecstasy. Her eyes shut with the shot. This is the moment, the cliched ending. The samurai is dying, but she does not run to him, calling his name through a veil of tears. Her hand does not reach for her eyes, her mouth, or her heart as she watches, as we watch, him die. She does not sign her body or the air with any gesture of love or humanity. Through her, only death can be delivered, the finishing touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that wonderful reading, Tisa. And thanks to everyone for coming out tonight. And thanks so much to the Lannan Foundation for making this possible. And I'll just say about the Dark Room that meeting all of these amazing people over the years, most of them when I was young, but some of them more recently, has been one of the best things I've ever done in life. I'm going to read a mix of old and new poems. So I'm going to start with 10 things I do every day, after Ted Berrigan. Floss my throat, wash my feet, then glower, kiss Curtis at 7:30 to shake him, feed the kitties philosophical tender, stroll the valley of dearth to Journal Square, keep the faith like a Benedictine under the Hudson, work like a yo-yo, nap like a bear, address endless emails to forgotten writers, jack the meter to stand tall, drink lust as if it were spring water, walk the muse when the coast is near, leave my friends and shadows generous margins for error. I grew up in St. Louis, but I learned many years later that it was just somewhat fate that made that happen, because though my family, my father's family is all from Missouri and Illinois, my grandfather, when he was a very young man, actually went out to California for a short period of time, and then, as was the case in the old days, someone got sick, and so he was called back to Missouri. So I always tried to imagine what it would be like to, I love California, what it would be like to have grown up in California, lived in California. So this is a little poem about his youth. Manzanita. Every morning the cry of steel against steel grows more bearable. The concrete walls increasingly harbor color. The desert heat the Herculean fans blow in begins to break late afternoon. All these pink and brown faces, once indistinct, have started to crystallize, and his accent, freighted with country pitch, keeps dimming. Only a few of the men he supervises suspect he's not a native. At the whistle, he hurries out to his Essex roadster, flying past ribbons of red alders, eucalyptus along the roads curling westward to the coast, where he shares a bachelor's bungalow. A year into his stay, the Saturday midday glare off the hill still feels unreal. The sand dissolving beneath his toes at the Pacific's rim fills him with awe he can only partly convey in letters home. He knows they are wondering when he'll return. No longer a mere engineering BS, but skilled in building and running every kind of machine, because jobs and plants abound across the city in Illinois. How can he convince them he has fallen in love with the nightscape of sleepy Los Angeles, how the harmonies of Spanish and Japanese, the Barbary air, the acres of orange groves and slow drives up to Santa Barbara are irreducible east of the Mississippi. Mostly, it is the lightless. It is the lightness with which he moves through days, as if winged, black and fearless. No need to pass or even consider it, for few here appear so pained to see a man wear his darker skin. Here he enjoys it, like the tambourines ringing in the spoon bread laid out at the AME socials he sometimes attends, or the banjo playing on Central Avenue that nightly strokes his dreams, till the church bells sing him to waking and he walks out on the patio, eyes adjusting to the gifts of an open sky and waves unwrapping themselves upon the shore, not daring to imagine the turns of fate or fortune that will force him to abandon this paradise. I was in Chicago. I used to taught for about 10 years in Chicago. And so when the Occupy protests began, I was not in New York, but I went down with a group of poets. I frequently went down to the protests at the Federal Reserve Building in Chicago. And we did a lot of different things. We had readings, impromptu readings, and then at one point we marched the Veterans Memorial. So this is for Occupy Chicago, Occupy New York, and all of the people inspired by Occupy. Occupy. Sunlight scalpels copper shadows from the frozen bull. In the quiet before and after, trillions course between terminals, as bites so infinitesimal they might not even startle an angel. Worlds are sold to other worlds. Even the moment of is for sale. Even the idea of God is a derivative, if written in the proper algorithm for the proper program. What assets persist in the wind howling off the channel? The harbor with its intransigent blue, pierced by tankers. What howling sealed off by windows glazed to resist the seas or humanity's worst fury? Still, we cry out on the street, in virtual assemblies, as if thought and gesture were not revolution. No one wants to die a banker, but a banker. This poem is called Suit, and this is for all of the ancestors that were invoked by Sharon so beautifully, and of course, most especially, Nelson Mandela. If sorrow is a suit, its weight is incalculable. One day he's gone, and you put it on. One day she's gone, and it sews itself inside you. Morning drapes your skin in its invisible fabric. Every memory furs atop a prior memory. Your limbs, your features, your senses extend themselves to accommodate the sadness. One morning you wake and try to wear this new suit in the bathroom or the bedroom, in the shower or at the front door, down the stairs of the stoop to the walkway hovering before you, and you finally realize you are carrying another body. His body, your former body, your bodies together, in and on you, and this slows you and stills you, weighs more than two bodies or many bodies inside your body. It's like the bodies are breeding bodies, metastasizing bodies, so much bone and vein and hair, and you touch the force, the heat of the seething arteries, feel the sheer new tonnage moving and pressing in on you. Grief sent like the first breath in a foreign country. You fear your entry, but you're already in. You think of flight, but woe offers no exit. You sing, you weep, you dance, but there's no way out, except one, through your own skin. This one, heavy with sweat, matted, half-shed, and broken by a delta of scars, smelling of something familiar, indiscernible, an animal, slick and smoldering like volcanic rock, as white as ash and death itself. Take it. You take it. You take it off. And since we have a musician here, this is a poem for a musician. I don't think I've actually read this poem that often, but one of the sort of major figures in my home growing up was Miles Davis, who was from Alton, Illinois, right across, and East St. Louis, right across the river from St. Louis. So this is a poem about Miles Davis towards the end of his life. Apostate. Unbroken, yet the pain of lifting your right arm remains unbearable. And, oh, let me just say this part. I know there are young people in the audience, so please forgive the curse words. But I'm channeling Miles Davis, so, you know, you got to stay in character. Okay. Apostate. Unbroken, yet the pain of lifting your right arm remains unbearable. Some terrible shit going down in your blood. These young dudes trying to be helpful can't understand what you're mumbling, so they nod and paint in traces of tired melodies that sicken you to your soul. Where the fuck am I? Following whatever it is they think they're hearing because you're a legend and you recall how astonishing and cruel you once were. Towards your elders and peers, still are, tearing out thirds from Bird and Diz's circle, cutting lesser trumpeters, scolding train, strafing tracks by Hayden and Evans, disassembling modal systems, driving that sweet group with Herbie and Wayne in the early 1960s, then Fusion, dropping out, funkulating, walking in late, blowing whether you cared or not, turning your backs to the audience when you felt it cord so cold they would send brothers and Swedish gals into paroxysms because they could never get enough of what you withheld. Now you struggle to cop a breath to shape a clean note. Death, keep on stepping. Truth is, they don't know a goddamn thing about Alton, Illinois. They don't know what really went down with the wives and children, the other women, all those sidemen whose shadows you carry around like pass keys inside your harmonies. How, like the tonic and sonata form, what comes around goes around and payback surely as a bitch, you're paying premium right now. They don't know what it means to be a black dentist's son, a scion, trained at Juilliard and in the dream logic of Harlem, returning to your daddy's farm long past grown, him leaving you to live or die in the sweat of your nightmares in your room above the barn as you battle the past, your ghosts and junk wrestling like Jacob the relentless angel that yearns to slay you, lay you out, so you keep swinging, burning in those hazy blues of back rooms and burning spoons, turning every back word, turning back to every word and tune that ever sustained you. Don't fail. Finding the breath to wield a grace note. Death, not yet. Tonight, amped to decibels to blow the eardrums clear of hearing. Bassists and keyboardists whose names you never learned or cannot remember. Ancestors and mojos and juju protecting you, even though your heart keeps popping like a snare drum and your ears register only a red buzzing. You mount the stage, or was that yesterday? When you prepare to state with your horn which your lips refuse to bear away, how it's not about being a genius or merely surviving, how nobody ever sees what goes down in the head of a brother striving so hard to make something beautiful and impregnable and lasting out of the margins of this blue life, how the dues you pay never suffice, and you play and play and play, thinking that moment will come, but it never does, or it came so often, you realize it only too late, like now, so you'll always blame yourself, assume responsibility. Passion is a song you sing on your own terms. The set opens, and you hold your breath to map the evening's destiny. Sound. Death, get ready. Thank you.
So when we founded the Dark Room Collective, one, of course, we were having fun. And we were, you know, you need each other. You need other people. Think like you, maybe. Read like you, maybe. Sometimes walk and breathe like you, maybe. you think you're adding something. Adding something that's needed, that you don't see. So there's something about that that never ends, no matter who you are and where you are. You said in class today that Gertrude Stein was once asked, what was the role of the contemporary American writer? And she said, the role is as it is, as it is, to continue language. So underneath or above all the other stuff, gender, race, saxophones, poems, twisted hair, the language must breathe on. How's that? Poetically. James and I work together. This is James Brandon Lewis. And I tell you that because you may need his name later on. You may need to shout it out. We may, you know. But we try to have a good time. Man. His name goes one way, south, a part of Africa, a name they can't take apart. Love, hate. Love hates. Wholeness, the wholeness of, the wholeness of the small human hyphen, a part of their time apart. Trials, ancestor, trials, tribe, trials, togetherness, a part-time foot, a part of prism, around movement, around she who tries, the Cape part, the Dutch part, in Soweto. They treated us like nails, son. Part Winnie, part Anansi, part ANC, a part of love, a part forgets, a part of hate, a part regrets, taking apart a part of their, a part time, a part time, a part of history, a part man, Della. Thank you. What's his name? Oh. Wow. When I was a kid, my uncle used to always say that if you were light-skinned, black, and you didn't do good in America, you were a waste of yellow. Now, you laugh, but in some places, that's messed up. In some places, that's okay. And I often feel right at the crossroads of those places, not because I'm yellow, but because it's, you know, it's really everything, writing poems. Susan Sontag once said, a writer is someone who's interested in everything. And what's that make the poet? Like widescreen everything. A waste of yellow. Remember his name.
up there. The uppity sun, a big summer, low luminance, same complexion as, oh, long light, the reach of history, its simmering skin of variance, lightly darkened or darkly lightened, what's his name? Emancipation takes practice, such a naturalist you mistranslate heat into hate, every guard bridge. If nature wants to lighten brown, let nature lighten brown. My name is not on any of the cotton I own. The earth used to be caramel. Can you go backwards? The earth used to be caramel, owned I cotton of any, not is my name. Pick it up. Brown, like nature, let brown, like once to nature, if garden every bridge. Practice takes emancipation, lightened, darkly or darkly lightened, variance of skin, simmering, say bridge! Reach of history, light, long, complexion, same, luminance, low, summer, thick, sun, uppity, the bear, Yellow of Waste, thank you. Now, only we would try that. It's no easy task. Suddenly, our names were more than our own, our drummers too. And as if the craft of our inherited calling had only two camps of blackness, academic and spoken word, best work, the work for all the work, had to work on the page if we wanted to be published, and on the stage if we wanted to be recorded. But mostly we just wanted to be whole, respected and known, and reviewed and enjoyed, and in in the tradition of variation, and a loud noise followed by many louder ones, and not always as lonely as an eye, and not always as burdened as a we, and never anyone's token, hyphen, bridge, honorary anything, or literary pet, even if listeners weren't reading what we were scribbling, and the readers weren't listening to what we were spitting. Even if an open mic never opened an open book, haters, and an open book never booked an open mic, favorites, an ironic browbeat, if you a sonnet, if you a star, you wish you were higher, a sermon, inter audience, the audio antithesis of academia, worrying text to talk and talk to text, how, entertainment, poor folk prosody, oral jewelry, flow. The problem with American poetry is there's not enough Africa in it. Bling Bling has more rhythm and imagery than both Dickmans. At the edge of subject, poetics. At the center of subject, prose. The uneven with its regression of resurrections, reverses, outdated show-offs like Villanelles and Sestinas, pretending not to perform, only costume form. The content of character, not the shape of content, shapes form. There's no such thing as formlessness. There's no such thing as formlessness. There's always form. Everything has form. There's no such thing as formlessness. Formless, less than form. Form is less than formlessness. Applause. All poems perform. Thank you. We're going to do one more poem, man. It would just take too much to say anything about it because it's all over the place, as you know. So I don't know what to say other than on the eve of the Million Man March, I think the Darkroom Collective was reading in Miami somewhere. And I remember walking through the airport going from Boston to Miami, and every other black male in the country was going this way, and I was going that way. And I experienced it the way, you know, how in cinema, when they want to portray poetry, see slow motion or discolored frame. And I sort of, you know how they always do Robert Redford. This is how it was in the airport with me. And I experienced something called Million Man March guilt. In that moment. So this has to do with having Million Man March guilt and having reading something called Notes on Prosody by Vladimir Nabokov while I was in, I know. And there's a lot of stuff in here, but let me just give you that. Nabokov has a great section on the metric foot. So I thought, marching, feet, foot, hey. So this, we call it the suppression of sound. But it's, thank you, you know. And if I do this with my eyebrow, it means we messed up. The suppression of sound. Thank you. a dream, a democracy, a savage liberty, and yet another anthem, and yet another heaven, and yet another party wants you, wants you, wants you, wants you, wants you to funk a pen, funk a puss, wants you to anthologize, then retroop your group, wants you to recruit prune juice. My peeps, my poetics, my feet, all the one, all the one, all the one, heel and toe. My peeps, my poetics, my feet, all the one, all the one, all the one, lowly, heel and toe. Brer feet and brer beat, repeatedly beaten, repeatedly beaten, repeatedly beaten. Brer feet and brer beat, repeatedly beaten, repeatedly beaten, repeatedly beaten, repeatedly beaten. Brer feet and brer beat, repeatedly beaten. Feet, 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 every feet a foot and free. Every feet a foot and free. Every feet a foot and free. A foot and free, agony and defeat. A foot and free, a foot and free. Every feet a foot and free. Every feet a foot and free. Every feet a foot and free. A foot and free, agony and defeat. A foot and free. Feet, 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 reverend feet, a foot and free, reverend feet, repeatedly beaten, feet, 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 feet. A million marches, two parties, one Washington, two parties, a million marchers, an after party, after marching, the after march, an after march, after party, after marching, all the way to Washington, another march, another party, another after march, after party, after party, after you know what, marching. After another march, I was marching, after partying and after marching, all the way to Washington, always Washington, always Washington. Uncle Jam, in jam, all the way to Washington. After all that marching, after all that partying, Uncle Jam, in jam, always Washington. A million marchers, two parties, one Washington, one Washington, two parties, 1 million marchers. Footwork, if feet work for page, shouldn't feet work for stage? Run on, run on platform, run on floor, run on. If feet work abroad, shouldn't feet work at home? Run on, run blood, run off, from run flag, from run bag, run on, run and tell it, run tell tag, run tell toe, run tell tell it, de-decorate intelligence, if so also de-decorate form, if so also de-decorate war, run home, in every war, bloods leave and bloods bleed, and don't come home. What for in every war? What for and don't come home? For war, for war, for war. In every war, bloods bleed and bloods leave and don't come home. What for in every war? What for and don't come home? For more, for more, for more. That for in every war, that for every drug. The war on drugs is a war on bloods. Run, tell it, a line is played, a section played, all up into it and involved. Into it and involved. Footnote. Take joke. Take note to toes. Clip note. Go home. Take note to foot. Race note. Footnote to feet. Foot hurt. Footnote to note. Sight hurt. Toe note to foot. Bottoms up. Sore foot to church. Stop running. If office. If oath. Broken vote. A line is play. The section play. The protest you press to test. Repeating itself, a section play. The line is played. A protest you press to test, repeating itself. My peeps. My poetics, my feet. Some ally, some enemy. Mostly tradition. The jive in, brer in isms. Pass out the words, everybody, the kitty. Is not a toy. Pass off the word. The kitty is not a toy. I owe roots and books to groundworks underground crosstalk of African telephone churches. All one, star spangled, funky. James Brandon Lewis. Thank you.
Good evening. Thomas normally, for the most part, decides the order. And I think it was some sort of punishment to have me follow.
He's a poor lawyer if he's
going to lie. I'm Major Jackson. It's such a pleasure to be back on stage at the Lensic. I want to thank the Lannan Foundation again. This is a poem called Mighty Poems, Pawns. And it was a poem that started off me writing about my father and I playing chess online, and now my son and I play chess online. And it's one of those poems where you're writing and something from your past comes up. And in my past, it was a group of young boys in Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, predominantly black community, ghetto. And I remember a group of kids called the Mighty Pawns, the Bad Bishops. And they were a group of chess players noted in the media for going to Europe and beating up on the Yugoslavians and the Bad Bishops. So I went with the Mighty Pawns as a title. If I told you, Earl, the toughest kid on my block in North Philadelphia, bow-legged and ominous, could beat any man or woman in 10 moves playing white, or that he had traveled to Yugoslavia to frustrate the bearded masters at the Belgrade Chess Association, you'd think I was given to hyperbole. And if at dinner time I took you into the faint light of his Section 8 home, reeking of onions, liver, and gravy, his six little brothers fighting on a broken love seat for room in front of a black and white TV, one whose diaper sags from a day's worth of dumps, it's a wonder it hasn't fallen to his ankles, the walls behind doors exposing sheetrock, the perfect O of a handle, and the slats of stairs missing where baby boy gets stuck trying to ascend to a dominion foreign to you and me with its loud timbales and drums blasting down from the closed room of his cousins, whose mother stands on a corner on the other side of town all times of day and night except when her relief check arrives at the beginning of the month. You get a better picture of Earl's ferocity after school, on the board, and Mr. Sherman's class, but not necessarily when he stands near you at the downtown bus stop in a jacket two sizes too small, pushing his shoulders up close around his ears as you imagine the caverns of his poverty and anger, and pray he does not turn his precise gaze too long in your direction for fear he blames you and proceeds to take your queen. I think one of the tasks of the artist, the poet, the filmmaker is to see beauty where others don't see it. For me, it's remembering this abandoned truck with all of these tags that kids in my neighborhood used to go to, just write their names all over this truck. Dreams of permanence. How many times have I driven past and not noticed the beauty of the abandoned truck, its black tinted windows safeguarding a homeless man's makeshift bed, or taken in that war of names, the faint, illegible, legible scribblings dashed off in weak light of a nearby lamppost just before city cops, seemingly patrolling only this part of town, rush to manhandle some shy kid who longs merely for the miraculous. A recognition unfound among his six younger siblings whose sprawling caretaking fades him to a name among names when needed and called in their cramped walk-up apartment. Here, in the open gallery, a lot makes, a canvas for the poor. This non-erasable truck, a quick aerosol emboss where he swiftly tattoos and revises each letter in a made-up name like gold till it glitters even in darkness on a city with its spilled tires, crumbling facades, and a sidewalk blossoming weeds detonating dreams of permanence. No wonder, then, each would-be immortal hasn't climbed the truck's roof and tagged the upper reaches, having to scurry their scrawlings fast enough to sign evidence of having been here. Samo, Dondi, Lee, Oz, then a make on the run. Sometimes I have to, I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I say, I am a poet. Why I write poetry? Because my sun is as old as the stars. Because I have no blessings. Because I hold tangerines like orange tennis balls. Because I sit alone and welcome morning across the unshaved jaws of my lawn. Because the houses on my street sleep like turtles. Because the proper weight of beauty was her eyes last night beneath my eyes. Because the red goblet from which I drank made even water a Faustian toast. Because radishes should be banned, little pellets that they are. Because someone says it's late and begins to rise from a chair. Because life is ordinary unless you plan and set in motion a war. Because I have not thanked enough. Because my lips moisten whenever I hear Mingus. Because I've said the word dumbfuck too many times in my life. Because I plant winter vegetables in July. Because I could say the morning died like, and no one would question its truth. Because I relish being sent into the coat room in third grade where alone I would turn off the light and run my hands over my classmates' coats as if playing tag with their bodies. Because once I shoplifted a pair of Hawaiian shorts and was caught at the gallery mall. Because soup reminds me of the warmth of my grandmother and old aunts. Because the long coast of my dreams is filled with saxophones and poems. Because somewhere, someone is buying a Rolex or a Piaget. Because I wish I could speak three different languages, but have to settle for the language of business and commerce. Because I used to wear paisley shirts and herringbone sports jackets, because I better get it in my soul. Because my grandfather loved clean syntax, cologne, Stacy Adams shoes, Irish tweed caps, and women, but not necessarily in that order. Because I think the elderly are sexy and the young are naive and brutish. Because a vision of trees only comes to wise women and men who can fix old watches. Because I write with a pen whose supply of ink comes from the sea. Because gardens are fun to visit in the evenings when everyone has put away their coats and swords. Because I still do not eat corporate French fries. Because punctuation is my jury. Because my best friend in fourth grade chased city buses from corner to corner. Because his cousin's father could not stop looking up at the sky after his return from the war. Because parataxis is just another way of making ends meet. Because I've been on a steady diet of words since the age of three. I apologize for that curse word back there. I recently married, and my wife lives in Florida, and I live in Vermont. And we're trying to make sure we see each other. But part of the courtship was me getting to know Florida. Florida for me was Chad's. That's all I knew of Florida. Oh, and Disney. Chad's and Disney. But I've been happily learning about the beaches and the history there. This is called On Cocoa Beach. I am revisiting the idea of Florida, giving my vertebrae a vacation from all the faded bouquets of urine in New York and the darkened policies of snow in Vermont. I'm revisiting the idea of my wife's imperial gaze. Her three cheese quiche and fluted mimosas are the masters of my mornings. I'm revisiting the idea of lawn furniture. By late afternoon on Sunday, my face blossoms like a passion of lilies as I admire the spectral grace of the sandhill crane. Or I'm caught lost thinking of Castillo de San Marcos and the first people, Temecua. I'm revisiting the idea of light and laughter and skin half transported by wind. I like to think of myself beside the crepe myrtle, pondering the logos of palm leaves and the kindnesses of beaches. You can have your sororities of pain and darkened subways. I will give myself to the great battles of clouds and surfs. Just three more. And I have to preface this. Before we started dating, I decided to try online dating. And I understand it works, you know, algorithm, you give it answer a bunch of questions. Creates an algorithm and finds the perfect match, so it says. But I was offended quite a bit, filling out all those questions about religion and how much money you make and shoe size and all that. So, but I got a poem out of it. I wrote this poem when I was teaching a poet named Jackson McLow and thinking about procedural poetics. So let me make a preface. This poem appears in a magazine this month, and it's the first time I wrote a note that says the views expressed in this poem are not the views of its authors, okay? All right. And if you occupy any of these positions, it's not you. It's the algorithm, okay? Okay, Cupid. Dating a Catholic is like dating a tribe. And dating a tribe is like dating a nation. And dating a nation is like dating a football star. And dating a football star is like dating a new car. And dating a new car is like dating an air freshener. And dating an air freshener is like dating a fake tree. And dating a fake tree is like dating silver tinsel. And dating silver tinsel is like dating a holiday. And dating a holiday is like dating a black man. And dating a black man is like dating a top. And dating a top is like dating a bottom. And dating a bottom is like dating a Tibetan. And dating a Tibetan is like dating a dragon. And dating a dragon is like dating a fireplace. And dating a fireplace is like dating a mantle. And dating a mantle is like dating a picture frame. And dating a picture frame is like dating Martin Luther King with Jesus. And dating Martin Luther King and Jesus is like dating a threesome. And dating a threesome is like dating a commune. And dating a commune is like dating an unachievable idea. And dating an idea is like dating the Enlightenment. And dating the Enlightenment is like dating science. And dating science is like dating a beaker. Dating a beaker is like dating a pharmacy. And dating a pharmacy is like dating a dealer. And dating a dealer is like dating a supply chain. And dating a supply chain is like dating a Republican. And dating a Republican is like dating winter. And dating winter is like dating Demeter. And dating Demeter is like dating corn. And dating corn is like dating pancakes. And dating pancakes is like dating utopia. And dating utopia is like dating an Amish woman. And dating an Amish woman is like dating a Luddite. And dating a Luddite is like dating a folk hero. Dating a folk hero is like dating Robert Zimmerman. And dating Robert Zimmerman is like dating history. And dating history is like dating a white man. And dating a white man is like dating insecurity. And dating insecurity is like dating a Hummer. And dating... And dating a Hummer is like dating the Pentagon. Dating the Pentagon is like dating a lost star. And dating a lost star is like dating a liberal. And dating a liberal is like dating a Jew. And dating a Jew is like dating a lamp. And dating a lamp is like dating a blonde. And dating a blonde is like dating a Swede. And dating a Swede is like dating IKEA. And dating IKEA is like dating Whole Foods. And dating Whole Foods is like dating a yoga instructor. And dating a yoga instructor is like dating an e-reader. And dating an e-reader is like dating a television. Dating a television is like dating a commercial. And dating a commercial is like dating a serial murderer. And dating a serial murderer is like dating Raskolnikov. And dating Raskolnikov is like dating a rationalist. And dating a rationalist is like dating an academic. And dating an academic is like dating a CV. And dating a CV is like dating a breadline. And dating a breadline is like dating a refugee. And dating a refugee is like dating a Cuban. And dating a Cuban is like dating a propane flame. And dating a flame is like dating a topless jihadist. And dating a jihadist is like dating a femme fatale. And dating a femme fatale is like dating Paris Hilton. And dating Paris Hilton is like dating a tabloid. And dating a tabloid is like dating a communist. I don't know how I went from that. And dating a communist is like dating cut flowers. And dating cut flowers is like dating infidelity. And dating infidelity is like dating a pool. This is my last poem. It's called On Disappearing. I have not disappeared. The boulevard is full of my steps. The sky is full of my thinking. An archbishop prays for my soul, even though we only met once. And even then, he was busy waving at a congregation. The ticking clocks in Vermont sway back and forth as though sweeping up my eyes and my tattoos and my metaphors. And what comes up are the great paragraphs of dust, which also carry motes of my existence. I have not disappeared. My wife quivers inside a kiss. My pulse was given to her many times in many countries. The chunks of bread we dip in olive oil is communion with our ancestors, who also have not disappeared. Their delicate songs I wear on my eyelids. Their smiles have given me freedom, which is a crater I keep falling in. When I bite into the two halves of an orange whose cross-section resembles my lungs, a delta of juices bursts down my chin and, like magic, makes me appear to those who think I've disappeared. It's too bad war makes people disappear like chess pieces, and that prisons turn prisoners into movie endings. When I fade into the mountains on a forest trail, I still have not disappeared, even though its green facade turns my arms and legs into branches of oak. It is then I belong to a southerly wind, which by now you have mistaken as me nodding back and forth like a Hasid in prayer, or a mother who has just lost her son to gunfire in Detroit. I have not disappeared. In my children, I see my bulging face pressing further into the mysteries. In a library in Tucson, on a plane above Buenos Aires, on a field where nearby burns a controlled fire, I'm held by a professor, a general, and a photographer. One burns a finely wrapped cigar, then sniffs the scented pages of my books, scouring for the bitter smell of control. I hold them in my mind like a chalice. I have not disappeared. I swish the amber hue of lager on my tongue and ponder the drilling rigs in the Gulf of Alaska and all the painted plovers. When we talk about limits, we disappear. In Jasper, Texas, you can disappear on a strip of gravel. I am a shrug of a life in sacred language. Termites toil over a grave. My mind is a ravine of yesterdays. At a glance from across the room, I wear September on my face, which is eternal and does not disappear, even if you close your eyes once and for all simultaneously, like two coffins. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Natasha Trethewey, and I just want to thank you all again for coming out to see us tonight. I'm going to read a few poems from my most recent collection. This is a book called Thrall that's dedicated to my father, and my father is also a poet. In the book, I have what seems like a very intimate conversation taking place in a very public forum, and in the only language my father will really listen to. Elegy for my father. I think by now the river must be thick with salmon. Late August, I imagine it as it was that morning. Drizzle needling the surface, mist at the banks like a net settling around us. Everything damp and shining. That morning, awkward and heavy in our hip waders, we stalked into the current and found our places, you upstream a few yards and out far deeper. You must remember how the river seeped in over your boots and you grew heavier with that defeat. All day I kept turning to watch you, how first you mimed our guide's casting, then cast your invisible line, slicing the sky between us. And later, rod in hand, how you tried again and again to find that perfect arc, flight of an insect skimming the river's surface. Perhaps you recall I cast my line and reeled in two small trout we could not keep. Because I had to release them, I confess, I thought about the past, working the hooks loose, the fish writhing in my hands, each one slipping away before I could let go. I can tell you now that I tried to take it all in, record it for an elegy I'd write one day When the time came, your daughter, I was that ruthless. What does it matter if I tell you I learned to be? You kept casting your line, and when it did not come back empty, it was tangled with mine. Some nights, dreaming, I step again into the small boat that carried us out and watch the bank receding, my back to where I know we are headed. Thank you. The book begins with a couple of epigraphs, one from Robert Penn Warren and the other from T.S. Eliot. They read, "What is love? One name for it is knowledge." And, "After such knowledge, what forgiveness?" As I mentioned, my father is also a poet. This is a poem that makes use of a line from one of his poems. And it's after a chalk drawing by J.H. Hasselhorst, 1864. Knowledge. Whoever she was, she comes to us like this. Lips parted, long hair spilling from the table like water from a pitcher. Nipples drawn out for inspection. Perhaps to foreshadow the object she'll become, a skeleton on a pedestal, a row of skulls on a shelf. To make a study of the ideal female body, four men gather around her. She is young and beautiful and drowned, a Venus de Medici risen from the sea, sleeping. As if we could mistake this work for sacrilege, the artist entombs her body in a pyramid of light, a temple of science over which the anatomist presides. In the service of beauty, to know it, he lifts a flap of skin beneath her breast as one might draw back a sheet. We will not see his step-by-step parsing. A translation, Mary or Catherine or Elizabeth, to corpus, areola, vulva. In his hands, instruments of the empirical, scalpel, pincers, cold as the room must be cold, all the men in coats, trimmed in velvet or fur, soft as the down of her pubis. Now one man is smoking. Another tilts his head to get a better look. Yet another, at the head of the table, peers down as if enthralled, his fist on a stack of books. In the drawing, this is only the first cut, a delicate wounding, and yet how easily the anatomist's blade opens a place in me. Like a curtain drawn upon a room in which each learned man is my father. And I hear again his words. I study my crossbreed child. Misnomer and taxonomy, the language of zoology. Here he is all of them, the preoccupied man, an artist, collector of experience. The skeptic angling his head, his thoughts tilting toward what I cannot know. The marshaller of knowledge, knuckling down a stack of books. Even the dissector, his scalpel in hand like a pen poised above me, aimed straight for my heart. This next poem is about the Mexican Costa paintings, and the Costa paintings in colonial Mexico represented the mixed-blood unions that were taking place in the colony across the 18th century. I was interested in them, of course, because of this idea of taxonomy, that with the paintings you had the father and the mother and the offspring they would have produced, but also the various taxonomies created to name mixed blood people right there on the painting as well. If you were born in mixed blood, Acosta, your name was recorded at birth in the Book of Costas. I was also interested in the idea that across a few generations, indigenous blood could be purified to whiteness, but that the taint of African blood was irreversible. So you had names like Mulatto Returning Backwards, Hold Yourself in Midair, and I Don't Understand You. This is a series by Juan Rodriguez Juarez, circa 1715. Taxonomy. 1. De Español y de India produce mestizo. The canvas is a leaden sky behind them, heavy with words, gold letters inscribing an equation of blood. This plus this equals this, as if a contract with nature or a museum label, ethnographic, precise. See how the father's hand beneath its crown of lace curls around his daughter's head. She's nearly fair as he is. Calidad, see it in the brooch at her collar, the lace framing her face. An infant, she is born over the servant's left shoulder, bound to him by a sling, the plain blue cloth knotted at his throat. If the father, his hand on her skull, divines, as the physiognomist does, the mysteries of her character, discursive, legible on her light flesh, in the soft curl of her hair, we cannot know it. So gentle the eye he turns toward her. The mother, glancing sideways toward him, the scarf on her head, white as his face, his powdered wig, gestures with one hand a shape like the letter C. See, she seems to say, what we have made. The servant, still a child, cranes his neck, turns his face up toward all of them. He is dark as history, origin of the word native, the weight of blood, a pale mistress on his back, heavier every year. 2. De Español y Negra produce mulatto. Still, the centuries have not dulled the sullenness of the child's expression. If there is light inside him, it does not shine through the paint that holds his face in profile, his domed forehead, eyes nearly closed beneath a heavy brow. Though inside, the boy's father stands in his cloak and hat. It's as if he's just come in, or that he's leaving. We see him transient, rolling a cigarette, myopic, his eyelids drawn against the child passing before him. At the stove, the boy's mother contorts, watchful, her neck twisting on its spine, red beads yoked at her throat like a necklace of blood, her face so black she nearly disappears into the canvas, the dark wall upon which we see the words that name them. What should we make of any of this? Remove the words above their heads, put something else in place of the child, a table perhaps upon which the man might set his hat, or a dog upon which to bestow the blessing of his touch. And the story changes. The boy is a palimpsest of paint, layers of color, history rendering him that precise shade of in between. Before this, he was nothing, blank canvas, before image or word, before a last brushstroke fixed him in his place. 3. De Español y Mestiza produce Castiza. How not to see in this gesture the mind of the colony? In the mother's arms, the child hinged at her womb, dark cradle of mixed blood, call it Mexico, turns toward the father, reaching to him as if back to Spain, to the promise of blood alchemy, three easy steps to purity. From a Spaniard and an Indian, a mestizo. From a mestizo and a Spaniard, a castizo. From a castizo and a Spaniard, a Spaniard. We see her here, one generation away, nearly slipping her mother's careful grip. 4. The Book of Castas. Call it the Catalogue of Mixed Bloods, or the Book of Not, not Spaniard, not white, but mulatto returning backwards, or hold yourself in midair, and the Morisca, the Lobo, the Chino, Sambo, Albino, and the No Te Entiendo, the I Don't Understand You. Guidebook to the colony, record of each crossed birth, it is the typology of taint, of stain, blemish, sullying spot, that which can be purified, that which cannot, Canaan's black fate. How like a dirty joke it seems. What do you call that space between the dark geographies of sex? Call it the taint, as in it taint one and it taint the other. Illicit and yet naming still what is between. Between her parents, the child, mulatto returning backwards, cannot slip their hold. The triptych their bodies make, in paint, in blood, her name, written down in the Book of Castas, all her kind in thrall to a word. I'm going to finish up now with the last poem. My father took me to Monticello over 25 years ago, and I knew in order to finish this book I had to take him back there. A lot of things had changed at Monticello in that time. For right now, it is actually the official position of the Jefferson Foundation that Jefferson fathered at least two of Sally Hemings' children, and the docent will tell you this when you enter. Now, because this has changed, there are different conversations that happen at Monticello. My father and I actually heard people talking about as if it mattered how much white blood Sally Hemings had. Enlightenment. In the portrait of Jefferson that hangs at Monticello, he is rendered two-toned, his forehead white with illumination, a lit bulb, the rest of his face in shadow, darkened as if the artist meant to contrast his bright knowledge, its dark subtext. By 1805, when Jefferson sat for the portrait, he was already linked to an affair with his slave. Against a backdrop blue and ethereal, a wash of paint that seems to hold him in relief, Jefferson gazes out across the centuries, his lips fixed as if he's just uttered some final word. The first time I saw the painting, I listened as my father explained the contradictions, how Jefferson hated slavery, though out of necessity, my father said, had to own slaves. That his moral philosophy meant he could not have fathered those children, would have been impossible, my father said. For years, we debated the distance between word and deed. I'd follow my father from book to book, gathering citations, listen as he named, like a field guide to Virginia, each flower and tree and bird, as if to prove a man's pursuit of knowledge is greater than his shortcomings, the limits of his vision. I did not know then the subtext of our story, that my father could imagine Jefferson's words made flesh in my flesh, the improvement of the blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with the whites, or that my father could believe he'd made me better. When I think of this now, I see how the past holds us captive, its beautiful ruin etched on the mind's eye. My young father, a rough outline of the old man he's become, needing to show me the better measure of his heart, an equation writ large at Monticello. That was years ago. Now we take in how much has changed. Talk of Sally Hemings, someone asking, how white was she? Parsing the fractions as if to name what made her worthy of Jefferson's attentions. A near-white quadroon mistress, not a plain black slave. Imagine stepping back into the past, our guide tells us then, and I can't resist whispering to my father, this is where we split up. I'll head around to the back. When he laughs, I know he's grateful I've made a joke of it. This history that links us, white father, black daughter, even as it renders us other to each other. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
For your attention and your time, we will be very happy to answer a few questions. The night has got away with us, so maybe we'll keep it short for a few.
Or maybe we're done.
Hi.
I can't.
He said he's completely enthralled. as he speaks, I'll repeat. The question was, with the music and the poetry, when did it start? And Thomas, could you and James talk about your...
Well, I'm going to try to answer your question in the regular way and then not in the regular way. There's something about movements and things that I love in history. You know, I always like the thing when it's, as we say, church. Whatever it is, be it the government, a football team you love, when it reaches that sort of spiritual / vibe apex, it's, we say, church. So that's slang. In the dark room, at the dark room reading series all those years ago, there was always that moment when the reading would reach that total togetherness, that place where we, no matter who we were, where we were from, and et cetera, many places, the writer or the moment of community would explode. So when we became the Dark Room Collective, touring around, just to have some of that carry with us, I thought, you know, maybe because in verse and prosody, prose and song, units of meaning, units of music, it's really always there, depending on how you nuance the object. And so in a weird way, a lot of ways, the music is always there. You know, the instrumentation or the industry doesn't have a monopoly on sound and what you can do, as you hear from different human instruments. So in one way, James, on the saxophone, in that tradition, were always there. But we met a year and a half ago, and we started to just hear each other. It's just a conversation. If you had told me 10 years ago I would have a saxophone player in my reading, I'd be like, come on. So it's really a continuation of things that were already there in the ways that the tradition, be it hearing Bob Kaufman, being here, what happened in the 60s, 70s, or before. You know, I always say, you know, all the instruments exist already inside you. It's how you open to decide what to play, etc. So that's all, you know. The music is all, it's there, even if it's always, it's there in you and listening to you too.
Thanks. Hi. Where's Sharon? Yeah, Sharon would be the best person to answer this.
Well, it's not a collective.
Repeat the question. The question was, do we write collectively? And then the second part of that was, how are we a collective? Right. And no, we don't. We do not write together. But like tonight, I hear some overlapping themes, and to some extent, what makes us a collective was, like tonight, I could share something with you. On the way here to the theater, we stopped at a bookstore, and you should have saw us. You should have saw us, because it was like we were in our early 20s again, getting excited over books, recommending books. There was art the booksellers showed us. And frankly, I think ultimately that's what brought us together, not aspirations as writers, but more our identities as readers of poets and fiction writers and purveyors of art and patrons. So that's what brought us together. The writing part came after. You have to remember that the Darkroom Collective was a reading series first. And so our mission was to highlight authors, writers of color, that mainstream America was not paying attention to. And there was a lot of sharing of books, passing books back and forth. So it's interesting. I think there was times in which we did share poems with each other, first drafts, early drafts, and those reading series became an actual workshop on a few occasions with people like, you heard one, Toy Derricotte, and who else conducted an impromptu workshop? No, okay. I think I just made up some history.
I'm sure there were others, but I'm drawing a blank.
There were definitely others, but what you're missing is what you're seeing now is the end of a reunion tour. So when we were a collective and living together and pooling our resources and making a way for writers emerging and established and touring together and trading the books and being caught up in the beginnings of our own personal and private and public creative processes, that some of that collective energy obviously is spilled over into some of what we do now. I could recognize poems. I think, no matter what they try to do, I think I could recognize their work anywhere. So I can be, that's like being on the phone with someone when you're not on the phone with them, you know. And I think they probably would say the same thing about me. I hope, you know. And so we're not a collective that way, but as you get older, as it widens, as you publish in the world, as you gather other communities from the community that you founded or come from, the idea of collective changes, transforms, right? So even, of course, as in the space now, the collective gathering, listening. So we're not a collective in the way we used to be, but we are honoring the past with the possibility of the future.
Yeah. That's a good question. Why was Boston a confluence for the Darkroom Collective? That's a very good question.
Because when you run away, you go north.
And that was the capital of abolitionism.
And I was right.
Wait, I was already there. I was already
She was already free.
She was free. School.
Accident, aim.
John and Sharon were at Harvard, and Carl Phillip was at Harvard.
I was working at the Film Archive at Harvard at the time.
Kevin was at Harvard.
Kevin Young.
Natasha was at UMass Amherst, not too far away.
Natasha sent poems in to a magazine I was editing for, Agni Magazine.
Tracy Smith. Yeah, we should mention
Tracy
that.
Tracy Smith was
that
at Harvard.
We represent a fraction of the collective.
Yeah,
members
this is just
who
a small.
Yeah,
small
Tracy
group.
Smith was also at Harvard.
Who was at Berkeley?
And Godfrey.
I just think Boston is the underneath question answer is that Boston is one of those places.
It's a hub.
There's a hub.
All
that,
those educational, cultural institutions.
Art, cinema, bookstores, energy. It's New York, Boston, LA. You know places. You know when it happens. You don't know when it's going to happen. And
it's interesting. I do teach poetic movements to students, and a number of, I know, boring. Cities create a certain kind of energy and a vibrancy often around art, whether it's visual arts or in the case of the beat poets, it kind of starts in New York, but then they go to San Francisco, and San Francisco already had a scene going. Surprisingly enough, the Black Mountain School is surprisingly in North Carolina. So, in the New York school, right? So there's these regions.
They have Black Mountains in North Carolina?
This is continual. This has been for the past 25 years. But I think, you know, oftentimes there'll be a group of individuals who think along the same lines, have certain passions, and will come together. Someone among them will kind of serve as this this force of energy that pulls everyone together. And that would be that guy down there
and
this one over here. And as a team. But there was no manifesto, but there was a lot of passion. And I think that passion ultimately gathered to where we are today. But it'll be, I think that question also kind of underneath it is other questions about post-civil rights and access to education and also class. There's a lot of, it's a deeper question than what you probably imagine, but it's not just on the lines of region, although region is a big part of that answer.
I'd just like to add that one of the other things I think is important is we came together at the moment just before the rise of the MFA programs, and it was also in the wake of all of those kind of collective gatherings of the 1970s, and you know, we think also inspired in part by people like obviously Baldwin, but people like the Black Arts Movement. So there's a certain kind of energy at that moment that brought us together. So
yeah, we didn't just grow. It was a kind of a accumulation of energy around African American art and Black art that we just were fortunate enough to meet each other at a time.
And also in a place, I guess, you know, given what John was just saying too, that was conducive to people of color or, you know, marginalized people seeking each other out, you know, for community, for support.
And those writers, interesting enough, I think those writers, like, they were already involved in other movements. You heard Black Arts, the writers we were celebrating, Audre Lorde, so many poets and writers that we looked to. And that idea of ancestry was really important. There were books that I hadn't read before, authors I hadn't read before, that I was introduced to through the Darkroom Collective. And that was very powerful. Someone who comes from a working class whose only model for work was working semi-professional jobs or working construction. This was a group of young Black people who talked ideas and talked literature. And for me, it was so impactful. It was like I'd found family in a big way. We want to thank all of you for coming out tonight and spending this evening with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.